Sometimes in life, we struggle to bring ourselves to do the very things that we most need to do. We can be very self-critical about this. We can call it procrastination. We can call it a lack of willpower or a lack of self-discipline. I don't know if those things are useful. I know I go through periods like that where there are things I need to do, and at least on some level want to do, but it's very hard for me to get myself to do them, or it might require me a kind of ramping up period of hours, wasted hours, before I really get moving. And sometimes those are useful hours because I know creatively my thoughts are crystallizing in that time, and although it feels like I'm putting things off, it's that I really don't know what to do. But there are other times I can't claim anything so lofty, and I just have trouble getting started. We tell ourselves that we have infinite time to do the things that we want to do. My maternal grandfather died almost a quarter of a century ago now, and shortly thereafter, I went to my grandmother's house to help her clean up some of his effects. And their garage was his work area. He had a couple of them. He was an engineer, and he was very handy fixing things, so he had a long list of appliances and items of furniture and so on that he was going to repair or, for all I know, combine into something completely new. It was not beyond him to imagine that he might patch a torn lawn chair and attach an engine to it and go rocketing off down the street or into the sky. And I have little doubt he could have achieved at least some of that if life or some other stuff, I guess, hadn't kept getting in the way. Maybe sometimes when I visited, I got in the way. But now the opportunity had irrevocably passed, and it was my job to take all these half-finished projects and bring them out to the curb. And as I showed my grandmother one half-finished project or another, she remarked, not without some humor, "That man thought he was going to live forever." And that struck me like lightning. I was in my early 20s at the time. And whereas I had always had a dread of mortality, I guess I had never framed it in terms of piling up such a backlog of goals that one could never reach the bottom of the stack. Once you've had that thought, it puts a kind of pressure on you, especially if you're me and you keep adding new books. I want to learn so many things. I want to learn everything. But when am I going to find the time to read that? I say to myself, well, that subject is important. I'll make time. And sometimes I do, but not always. And, of course, making time means that something else gets pushed to the bottom of the pile that seemed just as important the day before. And it's also problematic to think about things in this way because you can't drive yourself all the time. You can't be all work and no play all the time. And so when you're tired, when you don't feel like tasking your brain, when you just want to unwind a little bit, the question is, are you going to finally get around to reading Titus Andronicus, or are you going to watch that Seinfeld repeat for the fifth time? Once you've committed, it's an irrevocable decision. You may steal the time back from some other thing down the road, but that time is not restored to you. It's just spent. Strangely, I was thinking about that this week in relationship to something you've no doubt heard about if you follow the game, the Atlanta Braves' decision to demote Ronald Acuña, one of the top prospects in baseball, in what was a transparent bid to mess around with his service time so that they could save an extra year on arbitration or free agency, as if they couldn't afford it anyway. Occasional guest of this show, Craig Calcaterra, has done a great job railing against this kind of chicanery. And David Roth, my regular co-host, had a terrific piece on it as well at Deadspin, which manages to connect the decision to the whole malaise that afflicts our society in what I call the age of "you'll take what we give you and like it." But it occurred to me that whether you are living for George R.R. Martin to finish the Game of Thrones series, don't hear a lot about that lately, maybe people have moved on, or you want to see the conclusion of the current Star Wars trilogy, or you just want to see Acuña play in the major leagues, we're all just a slip and fall in the bathtub away from missing out altogether, and that every day that Acuña is down, the odds of that happening grow larger. I realize this is true of everything all the time, but it brought it home to me. And when I start thinking of issues like that, I not only have the same fears that everyone else has, but I think again of what my grandmother said, that man thought he would live forever, and of all the things that are undone that I want to do. And then, with that in mind, I go ahead and I do nothing, or often do nothing. And it only provides so much succor to say, like Popeye the Sailor, I am what I am, and that's all that I am, and just accept one's own weakness. There was an outfielder on the Tigers in the 1920s and 30s. His name was Bob Fothergill. Given the very light lower boundary of 1,000 plate appearances, I know you know that the all-time leader in batting average for the Tigers was Ty Cobb. He hit .368 during his stay there. Number two was Harry Howellman, who won three or four batting titles and hit .400 one year. He hit .342. But number three was Bob Fothergill. He hit .337 in 2,693 plate appearances. Despite his obvious hitting ability, the name Bob Fothergill may not ring a bell because he's more commonly listed under the name Fats Fothergill. I'm not going to call him that because he didn't like to be called that. To him, he was Bob. He was also, to him and everybody else, 5'10" and officially 230 pounds. That, I promise you, is not true. You can look at any picture. He was, as Captain Beefheart once said repeatedly on Trout Mask Replica, large and bulbous. To my eye, he was proportioned a bit like C.C. Sabathia, just at a reduced scale because he was almost a foot shorter. But whatever his dimensions, the man could hit. In his best season of 1927, he hit .359 in 143 games, hit 38 doubles, 9 triples, 9 home runs, drove in 114 runs. I hate having to recite stats. They are the death of entertaining listening, but sometimes there's no other way to describe a player. The thing is, he didn't have much of a career. You haven't heard of him, even though he was a .325 lifetime hitter overall, because he had a hard time getting into the lineup and staying in the lineup. Part of that was a problem of timing, an aspect of his career that was not at all his fault. When he first came up, the Tigers' outfield was packed, and it mostly stayed packed. In his first seasons, they still had Cobb and Heilman, who we've already established were among the best hitters for average of all time. And the third outfielder was Bobby Veach, who wasn't quite of that quality. He was a .310 career hitter, but was pretty clearly a Hall of Very Good kind of guy, who at his best combined high averages with a lot of extra base hits. And once he was gone, they moved in Heinie Manush, another future Hall of Famer who hit .330 for his career. And then they came up with John Stone, another .310 career hitter. And then G. Walker, who had speed and defense and at his best in the mid-30s was a .320 guy every year. And as good a hitter as Fothergill was, a crowded outfield was more of a problem for him than it would have been for another player because his weight pretty much limited him to left field. You can't have a 5'10", 250 or 260-pound guy in center field, and you really can't have him in right field either because every hit into the corner is going to be a triple. The last thing I want to do is echo all the people who mocked Bob for his weight during his life, but even the newspapers describe him as waddling. Waddling is not conducive to good outfield defense. He took endless grief for this, both professionally and at the place where the professional intersects with the personal. There are many stories of players trying to get Fothergill's goat by mocking his weight on the field. There is one that Leo Durocher told over and over again, and Leo lied about a lot of things, but you can trace the game that he's talking about to the newspapers and the box scores, and although the incident isn't confirmed exactly by them, the contours are close enough that it seems like it's real that in a Yankees-Tigers game that was about to be called after 7 for darkness, the Tigers were batting with runners on. Fothergill was either going to drive in the winning run or be the last batter. And in order to shake him up, Leo Durocher came running in from second base yelling, "Time, time, the Tigers are batting out of order." And everybody said, "What are you talking about? That's Fothergill. He's been batting third all day, and he's batting third now." And Leo said, Oh, I'm sorry. I thought they had sent two men up to the plate at once. Fat joke. Supposedly, Father Gill was so unnerved by this that he struck out, which he very rarely did, and then tried to cream Leo with the bat, but of course Leo was too fast for him. Today we know that the causes of obesity come in many flavors. There's lifestyle, diet, exercise, even genetics. But none of that is to say that Father Gill bore no responsibility for his conditioning. He was what they used to call a trencherman. He liked to eat. He liked to drink a lot of beer. And yet, he knew the effect that those things were having on his career. Every spring, they made a show of putting him in rubber suits and having him run extra laps. This was a way of making fun of him, too, in addition to trying to get him into shape. And yet, he did not, or could not, or would not change. As a result, he couldn't compete with all those other guys that I named. As good a hitter as he was, he would sit. And there is only one season in his whole career, which lasted 12 years, where he played anything like a full campaign. And as happens to all limited players, as soon as the Tigers had other options, and they had the firstest, barest hint that he might be slipping off of that 350-360 batting average peak, he was gone. They didn't even bother to trade him. They just put him on waivers. And even then, you might say, well, he was 35. A lot of ballplayers go home at 35. That's a good run. And I suppose that's true, but you can't help the feeling that there should have been more. Not necessarily later, not at 35. That's hard for the best of players, but earlier, when he could have helped himself, when he could have fought through that crowded outfield by giving the Tigers another image for himself beyond blimp-like. And that was his teammate's description, not mine. But I think that Bob, like so many of us, thought there's time to do it tomorrow. There's one more beer and one more burger looking very attractive today. And there's dieting and jogging and the things that I gotta do, whatever they are, those will wait because there's time. And then there's this. He stayed in Detroit after his retirement, went to work for the Ford Motor Company, but the weight was still a problem. He must have been hypertensive as hell. There was one stroke that he survived, but a second one hit him on March 20th, 1938. Not quite 5 years after his career had ended. That was the end of Bob Fothergill. He was 40 years old. Harry Howman was one of his close friends on the team, and Howman used to kid him a lot. Bob was such a friendly, popular guy. He was actually known as the People's Choice in Detroit for many years. And after games, any fan could go up to him in a hotel lobby. There used to be a whole art of lobby sitting for ballplayers. And Bob would show off his swing and talk about what a great hitter he was. And Howman would kid him that he got most of his hits in hotel lobbies. I don't know if Howman also pointed out that he did much of his eating in hotel restaurants, or that he did far too much of his playing on the bench. Again, some of us figure we'll live forever, and whether it's taking off weight or getting that lawn chair hitched to that rocket engine, we can always get to it tomorrow. There's always something more compelling, more interesting, more important. And hell, we're only human, right? Just ask Bob Fothergill. He's right over there, on the periphery of your vision, just out of view, a pale and hungry ghost, pointing a finger that bulges like a sausage casing and saying, "Work now, for the night comes when no man can work." I'm Stephen Goldman, and this is the Infinite Inning Baseball Podcast. Time has come. You had been a good person, and so you arrive in due time before the pearly gates. The gatekeeper wears a green eye shade, and he checks over your paperwork with care. Well, that was very good. Yes, that was a good moment. Yes, charity. Yes, kindness. Yes, gave hope to others. Yes, all very positive. You can come in, but, he says, handing you a sheaf of blank papers, there are a few things we need you to do first. Specifically, we need a little more content around here. It is heaven, after all, but people still need to be entertained, don't they? They need things to read. And so, you are a writer in life, and we'd like to ask you, if it's not too much, to just write 7 or 8 or 10 stories before you come in, so that the people who are already inside can be uplifted by them just as you uplifted people down below. Well, sure, you say, but where am I supposed to stay during the time that I'm working on these? These are going to take some time. Right out here on this cloud. It's very comfortable. Do people get hungry up here? Yes, they do. Well, what am I supposed to eat? Well, there's kind of a coffee bar, a Starbucks kind of thing, just over on the next cloud. You can go there. Do they charge money? Yes, I'm afraid they do. Well, this gown sort of thing that you have me in, it doesn't seem to have any pockets. My wallet seems to be back in my other life, so how do I pay for them? Are you going to compensate me for writing these stories? Are you going to give me money? Money? This is heaven. We're a sort of a utopian commune. We have no concept of money. No, I'm afraid you're on your own for that. But how am I supposed to survive? Well, that's really not our responsibility. We're giving you an opportunity here, you see, an exposure to the great audience that we have behind the gates. It's a very large and select audience. And if you do well with them, why, the sky's the limit for you, my boy. Pardon the pun. Write the stories, and if you can just hang on for 7 or 8 or 9,000 years, we'll reevaluate your case and perhaps admit you then. You can be on staff. Staff doesn't need to eat. And you realize that John Milton, who is conspicuously absent here on the cloud, was correct. 'Tis better to reign in hell than serve in heaven. And better to write nothing at all than to write for free. And better than both is to listen to episode 47. The Wobblies used to have a song, "You'll get pie in the sky when you die," but that was pure supposition. Welcome back to the show. Today I am joined by Marty Appel, author of many books, most recently Casey Stengel, Baseball's Greatest Character, which is the latest of many biographies of the old professor, among them my own Forging Genius. But whereas Forging Genius was focused on Casey's pre-Yankees managerial career, Marty's book takes in the whole Megilla. And I am pleased to note that my own book appears in the bibliography, so some element of my own contribution is carried on in this one, and that's a good feeling. As I allude to in our discussion, or at least I think I do, I'll explain that in a minute, there are many biographical subjects who recur over and over again. Statistically, I think Abraham Lincoln has had more written about him than any human being to walk the earth other than Jesus Christ. Here in our country, George Washington, Benjamin Franklin, Franklin Roosevelt, there are a whole lot of Richard Nixon books. And some of them have something new to offer, and some of them are just recapitulations. And so, as a reader, you have to be discerning. But there are good reasons to go back to them, and the reasons vary depending on who you're talking about. But each story has something valuable to teach us that is worth restating every once in a while so a new generation can get hold of it. Not all of us haunt the used bookstores or the libraries or even the new bookstores, and these things just need to get recirculated in the culture so that they get some coverage, some discussion. With Casey, there are two aspects of it. One is, as Marty's subtitle suggests, he was a great character. The bigger part, I think, was his indefatigability, which is to say that he got knocked back a number of times because of the circumstances that he got to manage in. And I often wonder, when you have a manager who takes over a horrible team, and that team goes 60 and 102 and he gets canned, that manager may never get another chance, and yet it's not all on him. Let me use Alan Trammell as an example. In 2003, Alan Trammell's Detroit Tigers, his first year as a major league manager, went 43 and 119. They were one of the worst teams of all time. Casey could not have saved that team. Connie Mack could not have. Joe McCarthy could not have. Tony La Russa, Earl Weaver, any manager in the Hall of Fame you care to name would not have improved that team. And more than that, even in this modern age with free agency and other ways of jumpstarting a club, that is not the kind of team that's going to fix itself very quickly. And so Trammell got two more years and he lost 90 games both times. Other than an interim stint in Arizona, he has had no other opportunity to manage. And maybe he hasn't wanted it. Maybe he's happier being a coach. Maybe if you go 43 and 119, you have PTSD. I don't really know. I haven't asked him. I'd like to. But the bigger point is, obviously, had he gone 119 and 43 instead, he'd likely still be working. I don't know whether he would be a good manager in that case. I don't know if he was a bad one. I don't know if he was part of the problem with the Detroit Tigers. I just know he was irrelevant. Casey, when he was about the age that Trammell started managing, got a Brooklyn Dodgers team that was broke, that the bank had cut off, that the National League had to intervene to restructure, and had some good players, had some interesting players. It was not a 43 and 119 team. It was a team that, if everything broke right, might have had a 500 season somewhere, but there was no helping it. And then from there, he went to the Boston Braves, who were actually worse off. And as we'll discuss in the interview, Casey had his own sources of money by that point. And at times, he was advancing the Braves money out of his pocket to keep the franchise afloat. That's how bad they were. But not everybody knew that. And I do think that by the time he got done with the Braves, he was phoning it in a little bit because, let's face it, if you're paying to keep your team going, as a manager, it's probably hard to keep your interest up. And so, like Alan Trammell, there was every reason that he not be given another shot because people just take the record at face value and say, why bother? And I wonder how many Casey Stengels we might have been deprived of in that way. The interview with Marty is a little bit shorter than the typical interview I do here, in part because there were some technical problems at the beginning, and I actually cut off his first answer, which was really just, hey, how you doing? Glad to be here. And then because he just didn't have time to do the typical hour that I do, and that's fine. So I'll let you off the hook a bit early this week. Nevertheless, I hope you enjoy this discussion about this important figure in American history, not just baseball history. He really is an example of resiliency and all the ways that a person can bounce back from adversity and keep believing in themselves and try again. Casey once summed himself up this way: don't give up. Tomorrow is just another day, and that's myself. Sure, it's in Stengelese, but it's something we can all understand and aspire to. Today might not have gone my way, but I'm the man who is tomorrow. Tomorrow belongs to me. Before I roll Marty in, a few words about another player who happened to go by the name Fat. I didn't intend that to be a theme today, just a coincidence that I was attracted to two stories about players with that nickname. This one is a pitcher, a knuckleballer, Fat Freddie Fitzsimmons. In fairness to all involved, I should say that Fat Freddie was more stocky Freddie Fitzsimmons, especially compared to Bob Fothergill, who was as wide as he was high. Let's let Anita O'Day lead us into a break for a word from our sponsors before I get into that tale. It's a version of a song I've used before, but it's just too perfect for Casey Stengel, so I'm going to go with this Dorothy Fields Jerome Kern number one more time, originally introduced by Fred Astaire and Ginger Rogers way, way back. It's Pick Yourself Up.
Nothing's impossible, I have found, for when my chin is on the ground, I pick myself up and dust myself off and start all over again. Don't lose your confidence if you slip. Be grateful for a pleasant trip and pick yourself up, dust yourself off and start all over again. Work like a soul inspired till the battle of the day is won. You may be sick and tired, but you'll be a man, my son. Will you remember the famous man who had to fall to rise again? So pick yourself up and dust yourself off and start all over again.
Freddie Fitzsimmons was a really good pitcher for a long time. Mostly he wasn't a great pitcher, not a near-miss Hall of Famer or anything. Just a solid third starter for almost 20 seasons. He had a 3.51 ERA, pitching from 1925 through 1943. And for that period, that's a really strong ERA because the 20s and 30s were a really high offense period for the most part. The National League calmed down a bit faster than the American League did in the 30s, but still. He was from California, but he spent his whole career in New York with the Giants and Dodgers. One of my favorite pitching lines of all time was Ted Lyon's Sunday starter season of 1942. He was 41 years old. He made 20 starts, completed all 20, led the AL in ERA at 2.10, went 14-6, and had a .700 winning percentage. Fitzsimmons had one of those seasons too at 38 years old in 1940. Even though he was a knuckleballer, his arm tended to get sore. He had all kinds of physical problems. He made 18 starts. He completed 11, pitched 4 shutouts, saved a game, had a 2.81 ERA, and a 16-2 record, which meant that he led the National League in winning percentage. And I know we sabermetric types are not supposed to put too much stock in one-loss record, and I don't. But still, 16-2 is pretty cool, and for the most part, a pitcher with a 16-2 record and a 2.81 ERA, he earned the record. So it's not like it's an unreasonable shorthand for quality here. As I said before the break, he was called fat, but he was more stumpy. He was 5'11", which even then for a pitcher was a little bit short. Pitchers tend to run tall, even at times when the average American, the average player even, is not that tall. That's not the part I want to talk about. This is not like Bob Fothergill's story where I have a kind of a moral that I want to teach. Well, there is a moral, but it's a kind of small one, a useful one, but a small one. I want to talk about two games that Freddie Fitzsimmons pitched and the fact that he never won a World Series game despite several tries. On September 5th, 1931, the Dodgers were at the Giants. He was pitching for the Giants. Fitzsimmons had a one-hit shutout going through five. He had a four-run lead in part because he himself hit a two-run home run. The Dodgers broke up the shutout in the sixth, but still, as we go to the seventh, Freddie was having a very good day. And then all at once, he wasn't. Giants pitcher Fred Hymek came up in that inning, two outs in fact, and I don't know what Freddie threw him exactly, but whatever it was, he wasn't a strikeout pitcher. Even then, he struck out about 2.5 per nine innings, if that. And Hymek smashed a ball up the middle. It was a grounder, but somehow it took a high-velocity hop, and it nailed Freddie somewhere in the stomach or in the ribs or where the ribs meet the stomach. It's not clear from the different accounts. However, he went down. He was knocked to his knees. All the air is out of him. And from that moment on, he was unconscious. But Freddie had a great reputation as a fielder, and as testimony to that, he picked up the ball and completed the play and then fell on his face. He had no memory of doing any of this. The trainer comes out, both teams surround the mound, smelling salts are administered. Freddie wakes up, they pat him on the head, they hand him a bat, and they say, "You're leading off the bottom of the seventh, go get him, Tiger." Now, was Freddie really awake at that point? Was he concussed? It seems unlikely that you would get a concussion from being hit in the stomach by a baseball, but the man was unconscious, the man did fall down, so something was going on there. So he goes up to the plate, Hymek is out of the game now. Back in that period of baseball, they would let pitchers hit and then replace them, rather than pinch hitting for them. I mean, they did the other thing too, but managers don't seem to have always been as on top of things as they were. And of course, the gap between the average hitter and the good hitting pitcher was not as extreme as it might be now. So there's Freddie at the plate, and if we don't know if he was concussed before the at-bat, we can be pretty sure that he was after, because Giants reliever Cy Moore throws a high and tight fastball, and Fitzsimmons did have enough presence of mind to try to duck, but again, some days your luck has just turned. One minute you're pitching a shutout, the next there's a fastball crashing into the left side of your jaw. Fitzsimmons goes down in a heap, and for the second time, in the space of about 5 minutes, he is unconscious. And I defy you, in all the annals of baseball history, to find too many more players who have been knocked unconscious twice in the space of the same inning in the same game. Well, they get the smelling salts all again. They wake him up, but he has trouble standing. He needs help getting off the field, and he collapses again when he reaches the clubhouse. So, no, this time his day is over. The reported diagnosis was a ruptured blood vessel in the head, which sounds like an aneurysm, but it was probably more like a bruise. He missed about 8 days, not the rest of his life. He missed only about one start, so I guess he was okay. A minor note on that game is that Giants manager John McGraw brought in Carl Hubbell to finish it for Fitzsimmons. He picked up the save, which is a lot like bringing in Clayton Kershaw to finish it. A bigger point is that sometimes you duck fate, but it makes a second pass with the exact same roll of the great 20-sided die in the sky. Now we skip forward a bunch of years. Even though Fitzsimmons had that great year in 1940, even though he was a knuckleballer, by late in his career he was just a wreck. He really had a hard time getting and staying on the mound. In 1941, he didn't appear in a game until late May, and he only threw 82.2 innings all year. Still, they were good innings, so when the Dodgers won the NL pennant, manager Leo Durocher, there's Leo again, he keeps coming up, tabs him to start Game 3 against the Yankees at Brooklyn. Again, that sounds weird, a guy who only threw 82 innings all year, you're going to put him in a World Series? Well, the Dodgers didn't really have that much of a rotation that year. It was kind of a patchwork. It was a really veteran team. Four of the five main starters were 35 or older, so starting a sore-armed 39-year-old was not unusual for them. Fitzsimmons' opponent for the Yankees was Marius Russo, a great baseball name, not well remembered now, but he was a lefty who got in a few good years before a combination of arm problems and Hitler ended his career very quickly. In the game, both of them are brilliant for seven innings. There are four future Hall of Famers in the Yankees lineup. Joe DiMaggio, Bill Dickey, Joe Gordon, Phil Rizzuto. Three in the Dodgers lineup. Pee Wee Reese, Billy Herman, Joe Medwick. But the game was a scoreless tie heading to the top of the seventh. Fitzsimmons takes the mound. He gets two outs sandwiched around a walk. And that brought up his bete noire, opposing pitchers. This time there's no grounder. Russo hits a hard liner up the middle, which catches Fitzsimmons right on the left knee. He hits it so hard, in fact, that the ball rebounded way up in the air, as high as a pop-up, some accounts say, and Pee Wee Reese got under it and caught it. People were rather confused about what had happened, at least those in the stands, but the umpires had the presence of mind to note that the ball had never touched the ground. It had just gone zap off the bat, rebounded off of Fitzsimmons, hung up in the air for, I don't know, 10 or 15 minutes, and then Pee Wee Reese caught it for the out. Inning over. Also, Fitzsimmons' career over. Once again, he had to be helped off the field. You can see the pictures. On one side of him is Coach Chuck Dressen, and on the other side, another infinite inning friend, Cookie Lavigetto, and they took him to the hospital. He had suffered, incredibly enough, a bad bruise, I assume a very bad bruise, but no fracture. He said, "I guess I should have learned to duck long ago. When I first started pitching, they told me, all they can do is bruise you, but this is a bit more than a bruise, and maybe now I'm too old to play any other way." In fact, he was too old to play any other way. He was too old to play, especially on a bad knee. It never did respond, and one wonders if the diagnostics available at the time, x-rays and probing things with fingers, missed a more subtle injury that our better machines would have picked up today. He tried to come back, but between his sore arm and his knee, it was over. Midway through the 1943 season, he retired to become manager of the Philadelphia Phillies. He won 217 Major League games, but was 0-for-4 in World Series attempts. And within that 0-for-4 was a game he pitched decently against the Senators, but the Senators shut out the Giants, and this game in which the opposing pitcher tried to kill him. I mentioned before that Freddie was supposed to be a very good fielder, despite his girth. He had a windup that makes that sound even more unlikely because he completely turned his back to the batter. And yet, maybe because of that, there are more instances than I've told you about of batters pounding the ball off his person. Regarding this, he said, "That's what you get for being a good fielding pitcher. I've been hit everywhere, in the throat, on the wrist, and all over." And that strikes me as a strange statement because that's what you get for not being a very good fielding pitcher. Fitzsimmons, who is supposed to be shockingly agile, kind of like one of those hippos in Fantasia, just gets peppered with baseball. He's Charlie Brown out there being undressed by line drives. Like I said, there's no huge moral here. If there is one, it's that there is no incongruity in what Fitzsimmons said, that he was a good fielding pitcher, and somehow the universe in all its unfairness selected him to be barraged by more than his share of baseballs. And perhaps more than that, for some of us, at the turning points of our lives in our World Series games, in the midst of our shutouts and one-hitters and so forth, the universe paints a bullseye on us and uses us for target practice. And if we're lucky, really lucky after that, we get to go manage the Phillies, which is often even worse. This life of ours is perplexing and offers some very strange incentives, rewards, and punishments. We'll take our second and last break of the show, and then I'll be back with Marty Appel. The former Secretary of State Dean Acheson titled his autobiography Present at the Creation because he oversaw the beginnings of the international post-war order. My next guest could similarly title his memoirs that because he was present when George Steinbrenner took over the Yankees and was the PR director beginning in 1973. He has, in addition to his PR work, written over a dozen books, the latest of which is now out in paperback, Casey Stengel, Baseball's Greatest Character. He's Marty Appel. Welcome to the show, Marty. Your subtitle intrigued me in the sense that calling him Baseball's Greatest Character is a double-edged sword in a way. As you said, he was that. At the same time, he wanted to be more than that. It seems like almost you're inviting people in to experience somebody who's eccentric, but at the same time, it doesn't necessarily prepare them for every dimension of the man.
That's true. But when you look over the lifetime of the man, he enjoyed the reputation of being a little odd, a little eccentric, a little unpredictable. But he always felt in the back of his mind, give me a good team and let me show you what I could do. And that's why the Yankee opportunity was so rich for him. It was so perfect. He'd been in the game such a long time, never had achieved much as a major league manager, some success in the minors. But he turned to his wife, Edna, and said, you know, we could retire. We're out here in California where we live. I could manage Oakland as long as I'd like. But I got to prove that I could really win with a good team. And so he decided he'll do it for a year or two. He wound up doing it for 12 and won 10 pennants. But he just needed that one or two years to prove to himself that with a good team, he really was a good manager.
I mean, that's the thing that really fascinates me about him, too. In America, we, you know, traditionally celebrated young people who bootstrap, and we have the Horatio Alger myth of the boy who makes good, but he couldn't be a boy who made good. I mean, he did have a long and mostly successful major league career. He was a World Series hero as a player, and the circumstances that he had before going to the Yankees in terms of major league clubs were essentially 7 years of what the Miami Marlins are now, teams that were very hand-to-mouth, but ultimately he became an old man who made good.
Yeah, it's an interesting point you make there. Another point that sort of emerges from all of this is the similarity to Joe Torre, who also had a long, undistinguished National League managing career. Casey Stengel came to the Yankees, and they said the Yankees have hired a clown. And then Joe Torre came to the Yankees, and the headline was Clueless Joe. And within 5 years, both of them had their ticket punched to Cooperstown. So there was a parallel there that I don't think too many people were aware of or pointed out during Tory's era.
It's very true. Dave Kaplan, who was the director of the Yogi Berra Museum, was, I believe, I don't remember if it was the Post or the Daily News that had that headline. And he once told me that people really misunderstood that one, that they meant that Joe, wasn't that Joe was clueless, it was that Joe didn't know what he was getting into. But certainly people took it the way that you've mentioned it. And the dichotomy is perfect, right down to the fact that one managed the Dodgers, which, as Casey would have said, was in Brooklyn at the time. And Torrey managed the Mets and then the Braves. The Braves was Stengel's other team. So you're right. You know, speaking of proving himself and, you know, give me a good team, one of the players that he had who was consistently a detractor was Phil Rizzuto. And Rizzuto said somewhat late in his life, you know, those teams were so good that you and I could have managed that team and gone away for the summer and still won the World Series. Was that fair on Rizzuto's part?
You know, Casey did what nobody else had ever done, won 5 straight World Series. And if you say it was push button, and if you say anybody could have done it, you're being unfair to Casey Stengel because no one else did it. It was uniquely his. Interestingly, because you mentioned Rizzuto, the players who played for McCarthy and Stengel preferred McCarthy. The players who later on played for Ralph Houk and Casey Stengel preferred Ralph Houk. Nevertheless, nobody had any complaints when they were cashing their World Series checks every year. So even the grumbling players who didn't, you know, felt they should have played every day and couldn't understand, why they weren't in the lineup on a daily basis, they too, the complaining stopped when it was time to cash that World Series check. So Casey had to deal with a roster that really wasn't madly in love with him. Maybe with the exception of Yogi Berra, who he played every day and didn't platoon. But otherwise, as Bobby Richardson said, he was a tough guy to play for.
Well, he could be very harsh, and your book has many examples of him being a good guy and a generous guy, and I've certainly read many of those. There's a great story that Ryan Duren told me back in the day about how Casey asked him to walk down to the bullpen on a day he wasn't scheduled to pitch just so the fans could see him, just so they could see the number on his back and he could get a little bit of a hand, and that he would buy players dinner sometimes. But on the whole, he could be witheringly sarcastic in a way that wouldn't play today. How do you sort out the Casey, who was such a good guy, such a good talker, such a benevolent guy, with the guy who could also cut you dead with a remark like that and cause those kinds of attitudes on the part of his players?
Well, as Bobby said, tough guy to play for, very self-confident. I mean, he didn't hesitate to speak his mind because he kind of figured there were no consequences associated with it. I think it was interesting, he even took on Joe DiMaggio in the first week of his first Yankee spring training. Casey set up a rule his first day as manager, saying the players were forbidden from going to the dog track at night. He just didn't like that practice. Everybody knew this was directed at DiMaggio because that's where he went every single night. That was what they did in St. Petersburg. So Joe defied him. Joe went to the track anyway, decided not to pay attention to Casey. And what did Casey do? Nothing. He just said, well, I wasn't there myself. I didn't see him, so I have no comment on it. So Casey made his point, but at the same time, he established that he's the manager.
His greatest player was not necessarily DiMaggio, who was mostly hurt and then in decline. He played for Stengel 49 through 51. It was really Mickey Mantle, but their relationship was complicated.
Casey felt Mickey never quite produced for him the way he thought he could. This was a shock to some people who read the book and didn't realize this. Late in his Yankee career, he was asked to name like his best players at each position, and he named Hank Bauer in the outfield ahead of Mickey Mantle. What happened was that Mick showed up at age 19 in 1951 spring training, and Casey was smart enough to look at this guy and say, oh my God, what have I got here? I've got Babe Ruth, except this guy hits with power from both sides of the plate and runs like a deer. So he actually expected, when he first saw Mickey Mantle, that he had a guy better than Babe Ruth, if we can believe that. As it turned out, Mick won two MVP awards for Casey, won a triple crown, got in all those World Series. But Casey felt Mickey was never quite what he could have been. He saw him as a guy who really could potentially surpass Babe Ruth. So as a result, he was, you would have to say, a disappointment to Casey Stengel, as hard as that is to imagine.
I have one question about that, and this is something that I've kicked around for myself for years and years, and it's something that I think in the book you also kind of dance around the edges of. And again, there's not always consistency with Casey. As you point out, Casey preferred players who might take a drink every now and again. I'm not saying he was pro-alcoholism, which I mentioned Ryan Duren earlier. Ryan Duren used to say that was a terrible problem on that club. But that, I think it was about Bobby Richardson who said he doesn't drink, he doesn't smoke, he doesn't curse, and he doesn't hit. So, I mean, he had those issues. At the same time, what I've always wondered is, when Casey had all of these criticisms of Mantle, even knowing his many injuries, even saying he's the best player he's ever seen on one leg and things like that, do you think that Mantle's lack of preparation in some ways, or his lack of keeping himself in game shape, of abusing himself with late nights and a lot of liquor, were things that Stengel was subtly alluding to in issuing these criticisms, and it wasn't just that Mantle, you know, failed to be his version of what Mel Ott was to John McGraw?
I think you make a valid point there and a good comparison with Ott and McGraw. Casey also saw himself in his ball players. I mean, he was that kind of a player too. He wasn't really, you know, Mr. Conditioning, and he certainly was drank a lot even in his younger years. But now that he was older and wiser and kind of the father figure to the roster of players that he was dealing with, he did occasionally exhibit revisionist thinking on how the player should behave. He felt an obligation to his team and to the ethics of being a manager to disdain their late-night behavior. Still in all, he was more likely to overlook it if they were producing, and if they weren't, then it became an issue.
Right. He would say, well, you say that man is limited, and you disappear him if it got to be a problem. I love the use of disappear as a verb. Everybody who comes to Casey, or as I alluded to earlier, a figure who has been the subject of multiple biographies, tries to add something new, to add another dimension to it. One thing that's different about yours is you had access to his wife, the former Edna Lawson's unpublished memoirs. What insight did that give you that previous biographers didn't have?
I think there was a tremendous find. Casey was kind of a one-dimensional figure before I discovered Edna's memoir. He didn't have hobbies. You know, those of us who collected baseball cards, everybody hunted and fished, it seemed, in the off season. Casey didn't hunt, didn't fish, didn't play cards, didn't go to the movies, didn't like fancy restaurants. He was all baseball. If it wasn't from spring training to the end of the World Series, focusing on every game, he was just reading the sporting news and waiting for spring training to come around again. So the Edna memoir finally showed another dimension of Casey Stengel, the man. The courtship, the wedding, their life together in a marriage, the use of their home in Glendale, California. There was a lot in there that we didn't really previously know, and a lot of insight into his deal where he struck oil in 1937 and became a wealthy man for the rest of his life.
He always said that that was like an annuity, not a ton of money. But from what you wrote, it sounded like in 1930s, 1940s dollars, it really did make him independently wealthy, such that he really could have gone away from baseball had he wanted to.
Yeah, he didn't need to be nervous about his next baseball job. This did give him the independence to relax when it came to that. And remember, 1937 was still the Depression, and Casey and Edna had lost everything in the 1929 stock market crash. So they struggled by on their baseball salary, which was largely minor leagues and not very exorbitant. And then in 37, they struck oil when such things were just really starting to happen in Texas. And for the rest of his life, he was really able to just take a deep breath and say, no problem.
To go back to what you were saying before about baseball being his one consuming passion, there's a scene late in your book where he is revealing to, and I think it was his assistant, that Edna was having problems that would prove to be Alzheimer's or something related to Alzheimer's. And you come upon him watching a Little League game. This is a man who is at this point, roughly 80 years old and doesn't need to see any baseball and isn't, I mean, he was a consultant to the Mets, but he's not scouting Little Leaguers for the Mets. That was just where he was happiest.
Yeah, the fact in that same chapter, the fact that he kept a glove in the trunk of his car, I love that. I mean, and occasionally would pull up alongside some sandlot game and take out his glove and have a catch with a kid or something who probably had no idea who this old man was. That was a beautiful little discovery, that glove in the trunk of his car.
That is wonderful. And on the other end of that, I mean, it seems ridiculous to say this because he's such a ubiquitous figure, almost everything in baseball, as you said, John McGraw to Tug McGraw, but he helped kickstart the Negro Leagues too, because again, in his spare time, he saw these African American players playing and ends up recommending them to the guy who founds the Kansas City Monarchs.
Right. And you know, one of the questions that you and I both faced as an author was Casey bigoted? Was he, anti-black or against for keeping them out of the game? So I wrote the book chronologically, and I knew by the time I got to Elston Howard in the 1950s, this was going to be something that I was going to have to deal with wherever the story took me. And I was relieved in a sense because I had really liked him by the 1950s. I didn't want to see him as a segregationist, and he wasn't. He was a guy who wanted the best players. He saw that the Dodgers had Jackie Robinson in Brooklyn. He saw that the Giants had Willie Mays across the river at the Polo Grounds. Where's mine? He wanted his. And he would be ridiculed over the years for saying about Ellie Howard, I finally get one and he can't run. And everybody thought that was kind of a bigoted remark. But the first half of that, I finally get one, was the really more telling part of that story, that he just wanted the best players he could get, and it didn't matter what color they were to him. And I guess more important than my reporting on it is the fact that Ellie and Arlene Howard loved the guy. They thought he was terrific. And, you know, I defer to that if there's any questions.
And yet his use of that kind of language for people who didn't know him, for example, Jackie Robinson had a lot of problems with him. And I think that goes to gamesmanship in the various World Series in which they faced each other, that maybe Casey used some of those kind of epithets that, again, you know, maybe came naturally to a man who was born in Missouri in 1890, but look very troubling to us now.
Harry Truman was born in Missouri around the same time and spoke the same way. It's easy to dust it off and just say product of their times, but I think that really was the case here. And in terms of Jackie Robinson, Jackie went public with his criticism, but it was of the Yankee organization for being so slow to integrate, and that was fair. It was 1955, and the Yankees still hadn't integrated. Casey, as the manager of the Yankees, answered Jackie back and said he was chock full of nuts, which was the coffee company that Jackie was working for. So the feud became Jackie-Casey, but Jackie started it by picking on the Yankee organization, not on Casey specifically. So you got to work your way through that tunnel and figure out exactly who's criticizing who and what's it all about. I'm pretty satisfied that Casey created an environment that so welcomed Elston Howard with no issues and no problems that he deserves credit for that.
And just as a contrast to that, and I'm not necessarily implying anything about anybody who came after, but Howard, who coached for the Yankees forever until he died relatively young, I think in 1983 or so, 80, I'm sorry, he really wanted to manage that team, and he never did get that opportunity.
That's true, and I was working for the Yankees in those years, and those of us in the front office really felt his turn came after the 1973 season when Ralph Houk quit. Dick Williams was hired. He was certainly worthy of it, you know, manager of the year and world champion manager of Oakland. But that didn't work out for technical reasons. The American League president said that Williams wasn't free to manage another team. That was the moment when the Yankees turned to Bill Verdon, where we thought that was Elston Howard's moment. So a lot of disappointment there, particularly with a very enlightened president of the Yankees in Mike Burke. But Mike Burke was now fading from the scene. George Steinbrenner was just getting acclimated. It was his first year as an owner. So there were things in the wind that were kind of out of our control. And, you know, if we had spoken up on Ellie's behalf, I don't know how much it would have meant anyway. But, I mean, for you to mention that is good, because that should have been Ellie's time.
Since you mentioned George, and I know this is an impossible question to answer, but Casey, since we're talking more about that period of the Yankees, Casey dealt with an ownership that was, I think, mostly hands-off in terms of Del Webb and Dan Topping. They operated through George Weiss, and up until they started thinking of selling out towards the end of Casey's tenure in 59-60, I think they mostly left Weiss and Stengel alone. But can you imagine a Casey Stengel coexisting with a George Steinbrenner as owner?
Well, it would have taken an adjustment, and we can't be sure that he would have made that adjustment or cared to make that adjustment. Ralph Houk certainly didn't wish to make the adjustment, and he quit. Casey, I don't know. He always had a job, and a lot of that had to do with just knowing the politics of the game and knowing how to handle the different owners that he was employed by. So it's purely speculative, but certainly he never had an owner like George Steinbrenner, nor did anybody else. I mean, the role of owner changed with George Steinbrenner. Previously, the general managers just ruled everything on the teams. They were the forces to reckon with.
There are a few exceptions, I think, like Larry McPhail, whose temperamental led to Casey getting that job because he punched out George Weiss, and that left Weiss momentarily fired, but then rehired and free to hire his choice of manager, Casey. But you're absolutely right. And I think something else that's interesting, too, and again, it's all speculative, but since Casey did have an independent base of wealth, he could have faced Steinbrenner more as an equal, whereas somebody like Billy Martin always had a certain amount of dependency because his financial situation was not parallel.
And Billy had a lot more alimony payments due than Casey did. But you're right, different personalities, different circumstances. Casey was a good politician, though. He might well have adapted to George Steinbrenner by just changing his game plan, just, you know, spending a lot of more time with the owner than with the general manager. He didn't always see eye to eye with George Weiss, and he let it be known when he didn't, but you know, in the end, he understood the chain of command and he adapted to it.
Well, since you bring that up in terms of the chain of command and disagreements with George Weiss. As a last question, Billy Martin was one of Casey's legacies in the game, for better or worse. But Martin and he were estranged because after the Copacabana fight in 57, Weiss had been looking to trade Martin as a bad influence on Mickey Mantle for seemingly forever, and finally got his way. Casey didn't block that from happening if he could have. In Martin's various memoirs, he tends to indicate that they were reconciled by the time that Casey died. Your account makes it sound like that never happened.
It never really happened. But Casey wasn't holding a grudge. It was all Billy. And Billy was the only Yankee who attended Casey's funeral when he died in 1975. Later in his life, when he was doing the memoirs, he tended to be a little more melancholy about the falling out. To Billy, it was always that Casey could have stopped the trade, and he had counted on the old man to come through for him and, you know, and keep him a Yankee forever. And when people would ask Casey about this later in his life, Casey would say, "Oh, tell Billy Martin to grow up. It's that's the profession he chose. He's a baseball player. They all get traded all the time." So to Casey, it was never that big a deal. Billy made it a big deal. And their paths didn't cross that often after the trade. And Billy chose to be very, very sensitive about it.
There's a parallel in Casey's own life, too, in that John McGraw, after all those World Series heroics, dumped Casey on the Braves.
You bet. And Casey couldn't believe that one either. Casey wasn't quite McGraw's boy the way Billy was Casey's boy. McGraw wasn't the one who brought Casey into baseball and, you know, taught him all the fundamentals. That was more Wilbert Robinson. But there's a lot of parallel there to what you say, and it's a good point that you bring up.
Well, as you know, I've spent a lot of time on Casey, and it pleases me greatly to see somebody else run with him in a major way, because I do think he is, whether you're a baseball fan or not, whether you think that managers are overemphasized, and in today's game there's a lot of a trend towards diminishing the importance of managers, but I think just the very nature of him makes him somebody that people ought to know about and can be a valuable example to people going forward, regardless of whether you're interested in 40s and 50s Yankees teams or not.
The fact that you and I agree on that means it must be that two Casey biographers feel that way. People ask me, are there any Casey Stengels in the game today? And the whole profession of managing has changed so dramatically that that's over. You can't even go out and argue with the umpires anymore for whatever effect and benefit that would bring because of the use of the replay rule. So you take that element out of the managing job. You take the instincts that you develop having been replaced by analysis by computer, and the manager is really a shade of what he once was, so that, yeah, the Yankees can hire an Aaron Boone today with no managerial experience because they know he's a smart guy and he can read the analytics. So the age of Casey Stengel is certainly over. If Casey was mentored by McGraw and then Martin was mentored by Casey, and to some extent, maybe Pinella was mentored by Martin, that's over. We've come to the end of the line on that.
Which is a shame, but things do have to change. And I imagine if Casey was around today, he would have curbed his tongue at least to some degree and focused the way Aaron Boone is focusing on creating a positive clubhouse environment less so on just kind of I don't know what the best way to put it is in terms of bringing more attention to himself than the players.
Well put. You're right.
Marty, thank you very much for doing this. I appreciate it. I've long admired your work and your long tenure in and around the game, and it's been great to talk to you again.
My pleasure, and thank you for the interview and the opportunity, and look forward to speaking to you again.
By Yerba's Latte, we have reached the end of another episode. You can follow Marty Appel on Twitter at Marty Appel, NYY. That's APPELNYY. And I guess if anyone has a right to append those initials to the end of his Twitter handle, it's him. As for me, you can follow me at Go Stephen Goldman. Why Go Stephen Goldman? Because Goliath will surely send help before the Alamo falls, Stephen Goldman. Didn't work out very well for Davy Crockett, who probably thought he was in Las Vegas anyway and was very confused by the whole thing. We have a sponsor now, but nevertheless, this episode is brought to you by the number 37. Our producer is Beagle Knievel. And I should mention, I would greatly appreciate it if you would rate us at the podcatcher of your choice, Stitcher, iTunes, or what have you, and you can write us at infiniteinning@gmail.com. That comes right to me. I'm a little slow to answer sometimes, but I try my best. Our theme song, which you are hearing now and have in fact been listening to throughout the episode, was a co-composition of myself and Dr. Rick Mooring. It's called The Infinite Man. Rick tells me he's a couple of episodes behind, so he still doesn't know about that t-shirt I mentioned last time. Well, if the spoon doesn't think that it's a shovel and dig through the morning oatmeal and strike Abner Doubleday's bones, I'll be back next week with more tales and discussion from inside The Infinite Inning.